Good morning, everyone. The next case on the calendar is Charles Andrew Fowler versus United States of America. We have present today Scott Robbins for Mr. Fowler and for the United States, Michelle Taylor. Is everyone ready to proceed?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Robbins, I understand you would like to say 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Perfect. You may proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Robbins, and I represent Charles Fowler in this cause. The issue that we're here for today is a narrow one, specifically whether the district court erroneously dismissed Mr. Fowler's 2255 motion as untimely. This is a case that I believe there are three separate analyses that all would lend us to the conclusion that it was timely. Essentially, the three are that if one construes this case or recasts it with the Davis analysis that we now have the benefit of, in analyzing it from that perspective, one must use the controlling law in Davis. And so looking at his denial, district court's denial dismissal of the 2255 in that context, it should be, his denial should be overturned and remanded back to the district court. Additionally, one could construe the appeal, and we requested that in our brief, as a leave to file a second or successive 2255 motion, which would cure any timeliness issue as well. And the third issue is that there is an issue of actual innocence in this case. This is an unusual case insofar as Mr. Fowler, having seen the Johnson opinion and seeing that the residual clause in 924C was pretty much identical to the ACRA residual clause, filed a motion based on what appeared to be the appropriate law at the appropriate time, well within the Johnson window. The courts have then expanded Johnson, despite the court's ruling that Johnson did not apply to a situation with 924C, expanded it over time, first with DiMaia and then actually with Davis. In this context, the case basically should be now looked at from the Davis perspective and essentially recast, more construed within that context, and therefore it is indeed timely and should be remanded back to the district court for further proceedings. This case is one where, again, the law has been changing, and as recently the government filed the Granda case as a supplemental authority. We responded to it, essentially embracing the Granda case as well. Granda says basically that one should recast this argument in the court now because it's still an ongoing case.
No, Granda is that timeliness is really not the issue in Granda.
Well,
the question in Granda was a question of jurisdiction,
correct?
Not timeliness. There's certainly discussion in there that might arguably bear on this case, but
yes,
strictly speaking, the issue there was not timeliness or the statute of limitations.
Right. In that respect, Granda is somewhat off point. However, within the context of it, the court does note, though, that you must apply the controlling Supreme Court law of Davis for the analysis in that case. Likewise, in this case, again, we haven't ever litigated the merits as such of the motion.
May I ask you a question, Mr. Robbins? You know, I think we're having some feedback from your computer. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Okay. Can you address though the court's? I know it's an unpublished case, but Mr. Page, the co-defendant.
Yes, a different circumstance entirely. Mr. Page had a resolution on the merits of the motion itself. This was a motion that was filed by the government to dismiss for timeliness that precluded that particular analysis. In Mr. Page's case, I think the remedy that the court eventually granted was to allow him leave to file a successive 2255.
Right, but wasn't it under Davis?
It had basically a similar. It was a little bit before my case, but a similar temporal situation as far as the timelines of when cases came out. But they ruled. But in that case, despite the fact that they are separate cases as such, and I don't think it totally converts it in that fashion. One still, for the timeliness issue, does have to address the current law. And so to recast this, which is this was the first 2255, this is not a second or successive one or anything like that, as it was in Davis. So the principle is different. What we're looking at here is analyzing the timeliness issue. And in the context of Granda, there's other cases as well. I think right, Trudy was one of them.
The question I have is in Page, he filed a 2255 motion based only on a Johnson claim. And right. This court said, this is really a Davis claim. And to the extent that that's what you're trying to file, you need to file a claim seeking Davis and not a Johnson claim. And I'm not sure then how we convert what your client has asked for in this case to a Davis claim when what he initially is seeking is a Johnson claim.
What I'm asking is not to convert it as such, and I understand Hamlund, and that is still the current law. I'm simply asking the court to apply the current law as it stands now, as it directs in Granda.
Right, but what your client asked for was Johnson, and under Johnson, it's not timely. Isn't that really what we have here?
No, Your Honor. Under the circumstances. Tell me why I'm wrong. Okay, under the circumstances, because it's still a ongoing case, I can't file a second or successive 2255 based on Davis until such time as this case is resolved, because this is the first one. So in order to analyze this and get to the merits of the case, one needs to look at the law as to whether or not it should have been found untimely. As it turned out, Mr. Granda was right that the essence of his claim was the essence of his claim was that he had that 924C was unconstitutionally vague in the residual clause, and in his particular circumstances, there's none of the issues in Granda where
right,
there
but
could
here,
have been.
Here we don't just have a residual clause. Don't we have another clause as well in play?
No, the elements clause I do not believe is really in play in this case, and that's where we get to actual innocence. The only predicates, if you will, in 924C that would apply here are the ones that were stated in the indictment, which were two conspiracy robberies, which under those circumstances, essentially you have a crime that is basically the law, you have something that the law does not make criminal. And there's, as far as actual innocence goes, there is no actual time limitation on that. And the court, for that basis alone, should not have granted the timeliness motion.
Would you help me with, how do you handle In re Hammoud, where we held that 924C3B was that it was constitutionally vague, was not dictated by precedent, as opposed to Johnson, which was dictated by precedent? The reason I ask, of course, is that we're bound to the statute of limitations in 2255, which says the period of limitations runs from the date on which the right asserted was initially recognized by the Supreme Court, if that right has been newly recognized by the Supreme Court and made retroactively applicable to cases on collateral review.
Right. Well, he has filed his claim for the subsequent 2255 within the motion itself.
For Johnson.
Well, he filed, but in our arguments, we asked for it also to be taken as a subsequent.
That's the question.
Yeah.
Can we jump from the one to the other? Would he have been able to file an additional claim under Davis as a new rule of constitutional law when it came up? Could he have done that too?
No. As a matter of fact, we attempted to do that just as a belt and suspenders approach, and it was denied as untimely because this is still pending now. And I believe at least members of this panel were part of that order. So we had to do it this way. Otherwise, would be to basically kind of punish him for being, go back to Granda. The odd result, the Supreme Court's eventual endorsement of a constitutional right argued for Granda's petition now precludes him from seeking vindication of the very right, even though he complied with the procedural requirements. Granda could not file a new petition based on Davis. That's a result that the court did not choose and said that they were obliged to follow Davis. In the same respect, when did
you file a motion to file a successive one based on Davis?
On Granda?
No, on Davis. You said after Davis came out.
If I can reach over here, that was filed before the time limit ran. If I can locate it here, we filed it on the 23rd, June 23rd, 2020, which was prior to it running. We received the opinion in case number 20-122728. The opinion came out on the 30th.
And it says that successive app was premature because you had another.
Because they have this still pending. Yes, Your Honor. It would put the litigant in a untenable catch 22. And so the interest of justice in this case is to find that it was timely under the law as we see it now, and to address the issues at hand back in the district court.
Is this an issue of first impression? Because we don't really have this fact pattern in any of our published cases.
Well, that's my point. Because of the timing of all these cases, I believe this is sort of a unique situation.
Well, that's and what under, I'm saying. Is it an issue of first impression?
It appears, I perceive it as one, yes. I look for the perfect case on point, and I have not found it. Although there are some that
published cases. Not.
You're not talking about the ones in the federal appendix.
No.
Okay. The federal appendix cases are the ones that reference it. Of the published cases, yes. Granda, I think, is the first one that comes close to analyzing the mechanics to get to this issue.
And do you have a non-published case that you think is your strongest case in the federal appendix? You don't need to go.
There are a couple. I cited Trumby, and I believe I don't know that I've cited it yet. Trumby, that's at 813 Fed Appendix 351. There is also another one, 805 Federal Appendix 993, which is Blackman. Both of those talking about Davis represents an extension of the Supreme Court's decisions in Johnson and DiMaia.
You see the problem is that our court has already held it was an extension. There was a new rule.
Right.
But and let me tell you why that was helpful at the time to some litigants, because they didn't file under Johnson. And if we had not said Davis was a new rule, Johnson was back in 2016. When Davis came out, nobody would have been able to file under Davis.
I think that's really exactly my point.
Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yes, but that's why the result I'm requesting is in the interest of justice. You have a situation where—
But you see the problem. The problem is, I could agree that it is in the interest of justice in some sense, but what we're dealing with was what Congress did in ADEPA. And what they did in ADEPA quite purposefully is to make it real hard to come back and get a second or third bite at the apple. So they made it hard to file a second or successive petition. They made it hard to file again by building in some ways, a tough statute of limitations problem. And so what you have in this case, it seems to me, is what you have in all of these cases. The tension between finality and certainty, which is obviously what Congress was looking for in ADEPA, and the opposite pole, that you want to treat similar defendants in a similar way when the law changes, but the difficulty is that the laws always change. The problem is that Congress wrote this language looking for a newly recognized right by the Supreme Court made retroactive. So I guess in the sharpest point, the question I have for you is, what was the newly recognized right initially recognized by the Supreme Court in Johnson? How would you define it? One way to define it is what they said. We hold that imposing an increased sentence under the residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act violates the Constitution's guarantee of due process. That's the holding, right?
Correct.
They didn't say, we hold that applying this principle beyond the Armed Career Criminal Act, that is to say, in the context of 924C3B, is a violation of due process. They didn't address that question. And so you have to argue, well, they were really making a vagueness argument and it carries over. We can extend Johnson to Davis on a theory of vagueness. That has to be the essence of what you're saying, right?
Yes, Ron. And that's exactly what they say in both this Blackmun case, where they talk about Davis represented an extension of the Supreme Court's decisions in Johnson and DiMaia. That's really the essence of what he was asking for. The Supreme Court established. Now, I understand the reason why they say it creates a new rule, so that the people who did not have the forethought or gift of prophecy, or however you want to phrase it, to file this when he did under Johnson wouldn't be denied the benefit of the Davis case. However, those who are already in the pipeline on the Davis case with an ongoing case should be able to argue that case on the issue of timeliness and ultimately on the issue of the merits of the case back in the district court. If the intention of the act was to stop successive or multiple petitions under 2255, any other result other than what I'm requesting would do the opposite. It would require two instead of staying with the one you have.
I understand.
That's the issue, and that's the core of it. I understand it going backwards, but it shouldn't preclude those who were there when the essence of the rule was first developed.
Mr. Robinson, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
There is a published case, the Steiner versus United States.
Yes, Your Honor, I did reference that in my response.
Right. So does that one, in that case, wasn't it originally filed? They sought a, I think they wanted a Davis claim, but they hadn't made a Davis claim. They had only filed under Johnson, correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Right, and didn't this court say that that was not, it was not proper because he didn't seek a Davis claim because Davis has announced a new rule?
Again, were those cases where they was all, where it was not a timeliness issue, but it was a resolving on the merits case?
I understand that, but here, in order for us to get to the timeliness issue, we have to address the statute of limitations. And in order for it to be timely, it has to be a Davis claim. It can't be a Johnson claim.
Well, which is why we've asked that you either treat it as such, and I think the interests of justice demand it in this case, as that for the purposes of this unique circumstance, because it does indeed expand the core holding.
And if I ask you another question, you agree that the COA, the Certificate of Appealability, we're limited just to reviewing what has been asked for in the Certificate of Appealability.
That's correct. Although, again, I think these all impact that issue.
I understand. All right, Mr. Robbins, we've let you go way over, but this is an interesting case, and we'll allow you 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Ms. Taylor?
May it please the court, Michelle Taylor for the United States. Judge Lagoa is exactly right here. This was a Johnson claim, and Johnson did not open the window under 2255F3. Johnson did not involve the right that is asserted here, which is a challenge to a Section 924C sentence. Johnson was an ACCA case. And Judge Hall is exactly right that if this court were to hold that Johnson did open that window, that there's only one window that's contemplated by 2255F3. It talks about the date on which the right asserted was initially recognized, if it's been newly recognized by the Supreme Court. So if this court were to hold that Johnson was that date, then all of the defendants who waited to file their 924C motion or their 2255 motions challenging 924C convictions would be out of time. If Johnson really had established that right. And Judge Marcus is also correct that Granda doesn't address the timeliness issue. Granda establishes that when a court is resolving a Johnson claim, it can apply Davis. But if you look back at the record in Granda, the timeliness issue actually fell out of the case. There's a R&R by the magistrate judge that says the United States didn't assert the time bar here, and so I'm considering it as waived. So Granda proceeded to full briefing on procedural default and on the merits, and when it came up to the Court of Appeals, you had that record, which is obviously very different than what we have here, where we have a ruling that was limited to the issue of timeliness. There might be all kinds of situations where Johnson claims are before the court and the time bar isn't at issue. For instance, a Johnson claim that had been filed within a year of a conviction becoming final, or a Johnson claim in a case where the United States decides not to assert the time bar and that falls out of the case. But that's not what we have here. Here, there was a motion to dismiss a Johnson claim on the basis of the time bar, and that was the sole basis of the district court's ruling, and that's the sole issue in the certificate of appealability. And the district court got that issue right. Johnson does not open the window under 2255F3. The idea that you could apply Davis to Johnson claims doesn't address that time bar at all. We can't just ignore it simply because the court might apply Davis in resolving a Johnson claim. I also want to address here this new claim that the untimeliness could be excused based on actual innocence. That was not the way this was litigated below. Mr. Fowler argued that his motion was a timely motion because he had filed it within a year of Johnson. He didn't argue that his untimeliness should be excused based on actual innocence. So that's something that has never been briefed or decided by the district court. This court won't consider claims on appeal that were not presented before the district court. And that's really outside the scope of the certificate of appealability here, because the certificate of appealability was addressing timeliness in the context that of which it had been raised below, which was, does Johnson make this claim timely?
What are we to make of the fact that he sought leave to file a successive petition raising Davis, and he did that in a timely way on 23 June 2020, and we rejected that on June the 30th. If that's so, I guess my question boils down to, what is it that this petitioner could have done that he did not do in order to be able to raise a claim that he was sitting in jail for something that's no longer a crime?
I guess, for starters, going back to what to make of that, I do think it was correct that once the district court had issued its ruling on timeliness, and that was pending on appeal, that first motion, like there wasn't any jurisdiction at that point for the district court to have amended it to add a new Davis claim. Now it's pending in the Court of Appeals. And because you have that first ruling that's now on appeal, I think any subsequent 2255 claim would have needed authorization because, a contrary rule, if simply having your first motion on appeal as a placeholder allowed you to then file numerous other motions without authorization, then that would really extend that window of time.
I'm confused then. Did he file in the district court the Davis successive app, or did he come to us asking for permission to file it?
He came to the Court of Appeals asking for permission to file.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. Go back to Judge Marcus's question. Davis comes down, he's got this Johnson appeal pending. He comes to this court because he's got a year to bring Davis.
Yes.
And he files within 1 year of Davis. We say it's a new claim. And we say, no, it's premature because we got this other appeal pending. Judge Marcus says, what else could he have done to bring his Davis claim after we did that, other than try to have this recast as the Davis claim, since this court said under the facts of this case, it was premature to do it. What else could he have done?
I guess he could have filed a motion in the district court raising a Davis claim, but
you just said the district court had no jurisdiction.
I think that's the better view. There's a bit of a circuit split on that, where the Second Circuit has taken a different view. But I think the majority rule is that if there's already a district court ruling that's on appeal, then the authorization must come before there could be second or successives. And I think that is the correct approach. I haven't found published authority from the 11th Circuit saying that, but I have found some unpublished decisions.
He couldn't have filed in the district court. The district court would have said, you got to go to the Court of Appeals, because everybody agrees it's second or successive. So you've got to go to the Court of Appeals. Yeah. So he couldn't have done that. He's on appeal here. Some of this is because this case was held so long waiting for DiMaia and all of that, because it might have had a quicker ruling and then you might have whatever had a different outcome. But what could this particular movement have done to raise timely a Davis claim that he did not do? That's Judge Marcus's question.
Yeah, and I agree. If the question is, do we think he's been diligent? We do. He asked not just in that separate request to file a second or successive, he asked in his opening brief that in the alternative, could his request be filed as a second or successive Davis claim? And we're not trying to block his way to court on a Davis claim. We're just saying that this is not the time to entertain that claim. This is not the right court, at least not yet.
Could he have dismissed? Because my understanding is, so in November of 2016, this order is entered by the district court judge. Davis is, the decision comes down on June 24th, 2019. He files his motion under Davis on June 23rd, 2020. In the meantime, could he have dismissed his appeal in this case?
Sure, I guess I actually had another case where there was it was scheduled for argument and there was both a Davis claim and a Johnson claim pending, and the defendant ended up dismissing his Johnson claim so he could fully litigate his Davis claim. So I guess that's one option that he could have done.
I guess the problem I'd come back to, counsel, and I want you to help me with, you concede that he was diligent in perfecting his Johnson claim, and you concede that he tried to perfect his Davis claim in a timely way. It's just that when you add A, B, and C in terms of the statutory text, he couldn't get there. It seems to me what you have is really a catch-22 situation, that there was nothing he could have done or could do that would allow him to raise a Davis claim unless we read Johnson as holding more than it obviously held with regard to ACCA. Somehow it spilled over into 924C, which it didn't do. I mean, I think that's right. But it creates, it seems to me, a real inequity under the peculiar circumstances of this case for this petitioner, who's left effectively without a remedy to file a 2255 collateral attack based on Davis. Have I missed something here? Or is the answer, yeah, that's right, and it's really harsh and onerous, but that's a result of how Congress wrote the law?
Are
you any better than that? I don't know, because it seems to me to be inequitable.
In the Griffin case, which was one of our supplemental authority decisions, the court noted that in circumstances like this, where the COA was granted, it was a Johnson claim, but the COA was granted in light of Davis, the court noted that principles of equitable tolling might apply to make a motion timely when it had been sort of held up based on a COA based on Davis, but it was really a Johnson claim. In that case, the court ruled that the Johnson claim was untimely and didn't somehow become timely based on Davis. And I think, you know, similarly here, we're not trying to block him from having—
Let me put the question in the simplest form so I can understand it. What can this guy do now to perfect a Davis claim as you see it, if we otherwise agree with you, Johnson was a newly recognized right, Davis was not, we've already held that. What can he do? Can he do something now? If we agree with you and we were to say the language of 2255 F3 is pretty clear, he can't get around it, he can't read Johnson as holding more than that an increased sentence under the residual act of the Armed Career Criminal Act violated due process. It said nothing about the collateral question under 924C. Where does he go from here? Or is the answer, gee, it's tough, the law is hard and you lose? Is there anything else he can do is what I'm asking.
I think he could still get approval or authorization from this court to file a second or successive motion based on Davis. That the court denied that motion as premature while this appeal was pending doesn't mean that this court couldn't later grant that authorization.
Okay, let's just pursue that for a moment.
Okay.
So if we agree with you and rule the way you suggest the language compels us to rule, and that might be right, then his remedy would be to turn around and file another application with the Court of Appeals for leave to file a second or successive petition under Davis because of the peculiar circumstances of this case. And if he were to do it, and a panel of this court were to turn to the United States attorney and say, should we grant leave to file a second or successive petition? What is it that you would say about that? Would you turn around and say, no good, too late, the statute's got you?
No, we would not assert the time bar in that circumstance. I mean, one way the court could do that would be by applying principles of equitable tolling, but we don't intend to assert the time bar to bar a Davis claim when he has been diligent and has not yet had his day in court. This isn't the day in court, but we're not trying to prevent him from getting to court on a Davis claim.
So he can freely go forward in your view, and you would not seek to block him from filing a second or successive petition?
Assuming that he continues to promptly pursue his rights. For instance, if this court were to grant authorization and he doesn't do anything for 5 years, we might in that case say that there was a time bar. But if he continues to promptly, you know, if this court were to grant him authorization, we think—
On a second or successive petition.
Yes, we think he should have his day in court on the Davis claim.
Yeah, I'm reading from the docket, the order we said, okay, what this is peculiar is because this is still an original 2255. We didn't really base it on Johnson or Davis or anything. We just said he still has an original 2255 on appeal. Mm-hmm. So we can't, he came to the Court of Appeals to file a second successive, and I'm reading the order, and the panel was Judge Lagoa and me and Judge Luck. And what we said is a search of the docket shows he's only got this pending 12255. It's not over yet. So we can't, as the Court of Appeals, grant you a second yet because you're still litigating your first. So our order had nothing to do with Davis or Johnson. It was just that what's peculiar here is this is still his original.
Right.
2255. I don't know, because I guess he could have, maybe he could when we did that order saying, I don't know. I guess he could have, maybe he could have filed something in the district court. I don't know. A new or a motion to amend the one he had, but I don't know. And ask us to remand it. He could have maybe filed a motion to him. I'm just trying to think it through. He could have filed a motion to amend and say, here's my amendment, Court of Appeals, send this appeal we have back to the district court. Let me amend.
My original
position,
right.
Yeah,
I understand, Ms. Taylor, your view. If we were to enter a judgment in this case, affirming the district court, if we were to rule in your favor on this 2255 petition and say it was not timely, he could then turn around and file a leave with this court for second or successive petition, squarely raising Davis. Do I hear that right from the United States?
I think he's already even done so in his opening brief by asking his brief to be treated as that request.
I understand.
I don't even need to file something separate.
And it would not be the position of the government that he was blocked because of time or something else.
No, we don't think that we would assert a time bar here, given that he has been trying to pursue this Davis claim, since when that window is still in play. But let's
be clear about what you would assert, though, because in your answer in this, you never even answered this 2255. You filed a motion to dismiss, and in your motion to dismiss, you said we preserve procedural default in all our defenses.
Right.
So to be clear in this discussion, you would assert procedural default. This claim was never raised in direct appeal and is procedurally defaulted.
I would have to, I don't know yet what we would assert, but I know that there are all like procedural default, the merits, the possible remedies, all three of those things have never been briefed. We haven't even had the opportunity to raise them. And this is a claim where he didn't raise it in, you know, he never challenged his section 924C count out on his original appeal or at trial.
Right.
That would be on the merits, but the question we're asking is, would you seek to block leave to file a second or successive petition? And your answer is no.
I think her answer is no on time grounds.
The timeliness.
That's correct.
On timeliness.
And the timeliness issue is the only thing that I could say, I think, given his diligence. The other issues, frankly, haven't been briefed or examined.
I understand.
Aren't really straightforward.
I'm not suggesting this is the right thing to do, but you just said he's asking us to treat the brief he's filed here as a leave to amend as an application in itself, given we said the other was premature.
For a second successive.
To treat this, do two things here. One, affirm the dismissal as the other one is time barred, but construe this also as an application, as an independent application to file a Davis claim, grant it, and tell him to go back to the district court and start anew his Davis claim. You're saying the government doesn't oppose that as a remedy, as long as all issues, defenses, we make it clear. That's a very unusual thing, but we are the Court of Appeals. You know, we could tell him today, we'll hold the case, go file a motion to file a successive, and we'll go file an independent motion to file a successive. We'll say it's, we'll assign it to this panel, and that's what we'll do. To not mess up the law on Johnson and Davis being separate claims, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, and I think that's the most important thing, Judge Hull, is that there's been so much confusion as to what you do with Johnson claims that really should have been Davis claims. And it seems like the unpublished decisions are sort of all over the map on that.
Yeah, they're inconsistent. Some of them have remanded and some of them have said, nope, it was a separate claim, goodbye.
But you agree that the most important thing is to preserve the concept that if a new substantive law is done, that people need to be able to have the right to assert that. And so if we sort of meld things together, that could be a potential problem for people asserting their rights that are new rights, new substantive rights.
Right, I think it creates a lot of confusion. And I think, you know, Congress did give very clear guidance talking about the date on which the right asserted was initially recognized and newly recognized. And that happened in Davis, it didn't happen in Johnson. So the district court's time bar ruling here was entirely correct.
Yeah, and that's why we have to say, because it says right was recognized, and it's not just substantive law, it's a new rule of constitutional law made retroactive by the Supreme Court. So it's a very unusual situation. We have two of them so close together like this. That I've never seen this so close together problem. But DiMaio, Johnson, all of that created that.
All right, Ms. Taylor, thank you very much for your time and your argument. We really appreciate it. Mr. Robbins, you still have time remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. Scott Robbins again on behalf of Mr. Fowler. I think the court has the essence of what I've been trying to say and perhaps said it more eloquently than I.
The problem is we don't have the answer.
Well, but therein lies the problem, is that for this particular set of circumstances, it was phrased as a catch-22 to allow the timeliness issue to thwart this would essentially have created a catch-22. The answers are, again, on page 11, I did ask for this to be considered a request for a second or substantive 2255 based on Davis, and I don't think that's really inconsistent with Hammond. If one were to carve out an exception to Hammond for this particular circumstance, which is really, I think the court has it as a kind of a case of first impression, that would be one remedy. A second remedy that was suggested is because the court in the 2012-2272H case gave me leave to, it was denied without prejudice, specifically give a time frame in which to refile now that this issue is resolved. Again, the only remedy that I see under the law that I could do to make sure I preserved are the
right, two. But Ms. Robbins, if you heard Ms. Taylor right, and at least I heard it this way,
yes.
She's saying, I'm not gonna block you on timeliness grounds, whether we consider this brief as a petition for leave to file a second or successive or not, and we give her leave to file, you have the leave to file it some timely way down the road pretty soon here and after, she's not going to object on grounds of timeliness to stop you from filing the second or successive. That's what she said.
Right, no, I understand.
I take that as a clear concession on her part. Doesn't that solve your problem? It doesn't answer all the underlying questions of procedural default and all this other business, but it gets you in the door. It gets your ticket stamped that you can walk into a courthouse and be heard. That's what you're seeking, and she's conceding that you ought to be given that opportunity. So doesn't that take you exactly where you want to go with the very thing that's before us?
Yes, Your Honor, that gets me to what I'm trying to accomplish today. I'm simply trying to get back to the district court so that someone who is convicted of a crime that essentially doesn't exist is not languishing for that crime. And that would get me there. I'm just saying there's a variety of ways to get there if the
what
court
do you
were not inclined
most,
to do that.
Let me ask your opinion. What's the most efficacious way for us to do it? Consistent with our reading of the law and what we've already said.
To simply
read this as a new petition for leave, or to give you leave to just to give you time within which to do it?
Either way gets me to the same place, probably the most efficient that would not cause one to have to readdress Hammond in a significant way would be to do it by simply giving me, based on the denial of my motion and the request that I already made, giving me a time to refile that won't be contested for timeliness. That will get me to where I'm trying to get, and I'm not in any way trying to dissuade the court from that approach.
If I sat where you sat, Mr. Robbins, I would say, thank you very much, Your Honors. That's all I want. And she's conceded it.
Oh, no, I'm very happy with that, Your Honor. I was just, in case the court wasn't inclined, I was just suggesting there were other ways as well. But I am happy to get back.
My only concern is that I'll get filed. It'll get assigned to a different panel. Our staff attorney may write an order. This is 2 years after Davis. Denied on his face is untimely. So we got that problem.
Well,
I don't know. The panel can talk about it, how best to do it. You could also tomorrow file a new application.
It's
based on Davis as a separate thing.
I guess if I were you, Mr. Robbins, what I would say is the government is perfectly happy to take the pleading in the briefs here as an application for leave to file a second or successive, and it's pending before this panel at this time.
That serves my purposes, Your Honor.
All right, well, we have let everyone go way over the time, and we thank you both for your argument. It's been wonderful. Mr. Robbins, I know that I want to recognize that you are court-appointed counsel, and we thank you for your service, and we thank you for accepting the appointment. We really do. You've done a great job, both of you, Ms. Taylor, as well. Thank you both for your argument, and have a great day.
Thank you.